If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM, let's create.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio. Yo, yo, yo.
Hey.
You are listening to Waiting on Reparations. My name is Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we're here and we're back in effect another week. It is the second week of Black History Month. How are you holding up and celebrating?
I'm good. So one way I'm celebrating is posting. So the full archives of the Black Panther newspaper are available online. And so I've been posting just pages of it, you know, with the ones with like cool visuals as well as like descriptions of what they contain. So today, you know, I posted the Black Panther 10-point program. A couple days ago, I posted about Huey Newton, one of the founders of the Black Panthers. And so I'm just trying to do my best to like elevate the parts of Black history that people don't want to talk about because it does not serve their political agenda and things like that. So yeah. What about you?
That's what's up.
How you celebrating?
I have been celebrating. I mean, this is kind of like some down the line sort of celebration, but one of the things I'm trying to organize, I'm trying to put together a little festival in Savannah, like a music festival, but have it be like a fundraiser for Stacey Abrams.
Oh, that's what's up.
Yeah, either Stacey Abrams or something to do with Georgia voting. One of the two things I'm just gonna focus around. I know that's like, I'm planning it to be around like 420.
Oh, that sounds
but,
dope.
You know, planning it now, so it's technically my Black History Month celebration. You know who's not celebrating Black History Month?
Joe Rogan. He's not only been disinvited from the cookout, like he's not even allowed to eat barbecue.
Wait, was Joe Rogan ever really invited to the cookout? This whole thing, you know, when everything was going down, it was one of those rare occasions where I was on Twitter, like to start my day, and just was kind of vegging out on Twitter for most of the night before and the day. So like, I kind of saw all this shit happening in real time. And like, first it was the, okay, so for anybody who doesn't know, so Joe Rogan, one of the biggest podcasters in the world, he hosts a show called The Joe Rogan Experience back in 2020. It was an independent podcast for years. Crazy millions of listeners and subscribers, all that whole thing. You, at this point, I'm just assuming that everybody knows who Joe Rogan and what his podcast is, right? So a couple years ago, he gets a deal with Spotify for $100 million, which now makes him a mainstream corporate entity. I don't give a fuck what anybody says. But, you know, Joe Rogan's had, he's had problematic instances in things on his show for a while, but it's all kind of taken head and come into public eye with his COVID disinformation that he spreads on his show. And that led to this whole standoff with Spotify, where Spotify standing by their $100 million investment. But you've got artists like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and others who are taking their music off the platform in an effort to not be associated with the COVID misinformation. But SCAD graduate, Savannah College of Art and Design graduate, and Grammy Award-winning artist India Arie took to her Instagram to kind of point out something that I, in particular, had been pointing out about Joe Rogan, just amongst my friends and stuff like that in personal conversation for years now, which is a lot of the racist, quasi-Nazi shit that goes on the Joe Rogan podcast. It's dispersed enough that, you know, you could watch 10 episodes in a row and not encounter it, but when it's there, it's there, and it's there pretty strong. And India Arie started off by running a montage of Joe Rogan using the N-word that was followed up by a joke that he told about going to a black neighborhood in Philly to see the movie Planet of the Apes, and a commentary about how the all-black crowd was like the Planet of the Apes, and so on and so forth. Joe Rogan issued an apology. For all of the cries of cancel culture, there's not really any cancellation going on. Spotify standing by him, saying that silencing is not the way to handle it. But for the most part, it's just illuminated this particular aspect of the Joe Rogan show for the general public, for normies who weren't really paying attention, whether they're supporters of his or detractors. So that is the situation as it stands. Like I said, there's not really any consequence to be taken out of it except for his apology, and that, you know, the opinions are now, you know, it seems like the opinions are now solidly formed. You know, you've either got the people who are like, oh, I don't think that's a big deal, or you've got the people who are like, hey, this is what I've been saying, Joe Rogan's been on this shit for a long time. And then you've got a bunch of regular people who are now either, oh, I didn't know Joe Rogan was like that, fuck that guy, or, you know, the opposite swing of that pendulum. I didn't know Joe Rogan was like that. Awesome, I'm with it.
Oh, yeah.
So what have you been thinking of this whole thing? However much of it you've been consuming.
Yeah, I mean, I've long been skeptical of Joe Rogan and, like, the Joe Rogan to, like, crypto-fascist pipeline veiled in the fact that he does have many different kinds of people on his show, his platforming of folks like Stephen Molyneux, like, even Elon Musk was just like not productive.
Don't forget
Milo Yiannopoulos, and so
we only know of him because of Joe Rogan.
It's interesting to me that this hadn't come out earlier. Like, you know, if people are watching his podcast religiously, and he has this, you know, million strong fan base, how did no one bring up before now that there were 111 podcasts where he used a racial slur? Which I then think, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's all I'll say for right now.
Well, I mean, okay, so one of the biggest reason why I think it's not even necessarily that people didn't notice, but he wasn't, like, mainstream then. As big and popular as his podcast was, I think having that Spotify corporate stamp, Fortune 500 stamp on it, it now makes all of that stuff, you know, an issue for him, because beforehand, I mean, for example, the video of him telling the Planet of the Apes joke, I saw that shit back in 2018, 2019. Surprisingly, do you know who put that out? Alex Jones was the one who first put that out.
See?
When him and Joe Rogan
See?
Were beefing. Alex Jones was like, all right, well, if me and Joe Rogan's not going to have me on the show, everybody thinks he's so cool. He's got a black daughter. And listen to what he says about black people. And then that happened in the summer of 2019, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something like you see it and you know, hey, it was getting posted around, but it doesn't really matter because ultimately it's just this dude's podcast in his basement or in a spare room in his house that he's doing on his own. So there is no... When you don't have, like, when there's no corporate entity to pressure, you know, about it, then I don't know. I think it can easily slip through the
right.
The
you got to go after the money. You can't just criticize Joe Rogan for what he does. Anybody in a basement can do what he does. He has the prominence that he does because he has the backing of Spotify, he has the backing of huge corporations, right? And so you got to go after the money. That makes me think of, like, with the Stop Cop City struggle down here in Atlanta, like when they weren't getting anywhere at the Atlanta City Council, they started going for the people that were funding the Atlanta Police Foundation. So Coca-Cola, other organizations, or even if you want to think about the voter suppression bill that passed in the state legislature here, I guess sometime last year, folks started going after Delta and all of these other corporations that were like, oh, Black Lives Matter or whatever. And then, you know, bankrolling Republican campaigns to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so another thing it raises for me is like how unfortunate it is, but necessary to like bring the receipts. Like everyone knew he was shitty for a long time. It took like a comprehensive compilation of all the reasons why. And like, here are the links for people to be like, you have a pretty strong case. I see that over and over again with like anecdotal evidence versus pulling like the actual receipts in a lot of organizing spaces where it's like people are telling you something's wrong. But until you find like the archival data where like the segregationist senator was conspiring to destroy their neighborhood, like that's when you find it like, all right, I guess I'll do something about it. So that also strikes me as really funny about the circumstance that we're in.
Well, you know, we'll have to expand on this because it's opened up, you know, further conversation about censorship and what is censorship versus what isn't. Should Joe Rogan be silenced? Should he be removed from the platform? And I definitely do want to dive into this stuff. We also were supposed to talk about the NFL coaching situation, but I think we'll save that for another day too. But I mean, before we go into what we're talking about for the day, I do just want to touch on that one subject. It's just, if the only thing that existed in this situation was the compilation of the N-word, I don't think it would be that big of a deal. And just
like
me
to
personally.
The public.
Well, to the public. I mean, because here's the thing, right? Is like, he gave an explanation for the N-word compilation in terms of like, oh, well, this was me using it as a quote and I was recalling it in a story. Now, for me personally,
it's really not that complicated.
There's 23 N-words in there, and he gave like three examples of him, you know, quoting it. That it's like, all right, I'm going to need to see like a detailed breakdown of like how each of these was a quote. But besides the point, if just for the benefit of the doubt, all of those where he's quoting a story, he's telling a story or something like that. I mean, it makes me still not like Joe Rogan, but it makes me ultimately not really like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, yeah, I wasn't listening to that fucking show anyway. Fuck it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, but I think the aspects of like the jokes, and then when you further do even deeper digging and you look into the type of people that he's platformed, that's the aspect and the element of it to me that is like, all right, now this is still, you know, censor, remove, that's still like a subject for discussion. But that is the aspect of Joe Rogan that is like, oh no, this is serious now, because like, you know, you can say whatever shit you want. I don't care. It doesn't have to affect me. I don't have to listen to it. But if you're like luring people, unsuspecting people in by like, hey, we're interviewing an MMA guy, a comedian, a nuclear physicist, a white supremacist. You know what I mean? And you're doing that cycle over and over again. And I mean, I've people personally in my life who otherwise are like normal, well-adjusted, left-leaning people that have fallen down the Joe Rogan crypto fascist pipeline. It's very easy. It's not difficult at all.
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that the left has to get better at its media game. Woof. Like, you know, we have to win the conversation. We can't just say, oh, like, I guess to a degree, like, you shouldn't have these people on. Like, I don't think he should. But I think, well, rather than, like, censor him, I think we just need to do a better job of convincing people and creating our own pipeline to, like, liberatory ideas. Because otherwise, if this is all we have, if, like, all you have is Joe Rogan as, like, a huge name in podcasting, like, that's partially our failure.
No, that's true. That's true. But it's not even, you know, just personally, I don't know what anybody else thinks. For me, it's not even the platforming. Like, people that I check out, like Vosh, who's a YouTuber, YouTube, Twitch, political streamer, or even, what is homie's name who got fired from CNN?
It's Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo. One of the Cuomos.
No. Black dude. He was a commentator. He got fired
Mark
for
Lamont
the
Hill.
Israel. Mark Lamont Hill. On his channel, he's always talking to right wingers and like these fringe, like, you know, quasi alt-right figures who are spewing their shit. The difference is how you go about it. If Mark Lamont Hill sits across from somebody and the person says, hey, you know, black people have an intrinsic violent gene that makes them more violent than the other races.
He's not going to say, huh, Lamont that's Hill, interesting.
He's not going to go, oh, dude, really, dude, bro, is that word, dude? Like that, you know, that's not going to be, Vosh is going to like push back. Like there's ways that you can do it where it becomes a straw man to be like, oh, you want to silence, you don't want people to be platformed, you're afraid of discussion, you're afraid of debate. And it's like, no, motherfucker.
It's also debate. About how you engage with them. Yeah. If you're engaging like critically.
You actually have to engage.
Right.
Like for people to want, for the Joe Rogan stands out there, so, a lot of whom are straight up Nazis. And a lot of whom are just like people who don't give a fuck about issues like this and stuff like that. But if they don't want people to jump to the conclusion of, yo, I heard Joe Rogan said this, so I think this about him and everything that he is, then, you know, it probably would have behooved Joe Rogan over these years if, like, he could counter with clips of him passionately going back at, like, some of these guests that he has on his show, because he shouldn't be interacting with Milo Yiannopoulos the same way as he does with Cornel West. If yeah. I'm supposed to think that he's cool,
yeah, or know? Even just but, yeah, this like engaging critically with both of them, like instead of just being like, huh, that's interesting. Oh, black people's skulls are like concave, yeah, and that causes really? Us to. Commit genocide.
But that's not racist. I supported Bernie.
Yeah.
But, you know?
Yeah, like, you like, said you on. Might vote for him once. Whatever. The other thing I want to bring up about Joe Rogan, and like, I like to be hyperbolic sometimes because it's more entertaining. Like, there's a level of like almost stochastic terrorism that comes with COVID misinformation. And so, like, just a couple days ago, January 28th, a big fan of his and friend who was, you know, talking about his show all the time on his Instagram, comedian Christian Cabrera, died of COVID, you know, and we often talked in conjunction with, you know, loving Joe Rogan about, like, vaccine hesitancy and also, you know, spread a lot of Joe Rogan's vaccine misinformation. And now this person's dead. And so, like, he's a famous person. You know, he's a comedian. But how many other people who watched his show also were like, maybe that is sketchy and, like, are dead now? We don't know. We don't have those numbers.
Whether you want to call that murder or whatever, I don't think that it's even debatable that that has happened.
No, it's not even debatable. It's just like there's no way to know the impacts negatively in a very literal, concrete way. But
gone on about Joe Rogan for a while. So why don't we talk about like white people that don't suck?
So yeah, this week we had the honor to interview Joan and Loki Mulholland. Joan was a freedom writer whose mugshot was called one of the most iconic in American history. She at the age of 23 had participated in over 50 sit-ins and demonstrations like the Freedom Rides, the Jackson Woolworth sit-in, the March on Washington, and you know, knew some of the biggest names in the civil rights movement, from Medgar Evers, Fannie Lou Hamer, John Lewis, Julian Bond. And so we'll be speaking with her, as well as her son Loki,
who's recently made a documentary about her called An Ordinary Hero.
Yeah, and he's the executive director of the Joan Mulholland Foundation. Has actually directed several documentaries and wrote a book, She Stood for Freedom, which was nominated for awards. So they're both very involved in, to this day, in civil rights struggle in their own different ways. And this somewhat dovetails what we were talking about with regards to art and the role of, you know, shaping the political discourse, in the sense that, like, Joe Rogan's over here, he's got his podcast, which itself is a form of media that is shaping the political discourse. And Loki, especially as a filmmaker, is doing the same with his work. And we have a lot of discussion in the interview about the role of arts in movement making. So, without further ado, let's get on into it.
We'll be right back with that after the jump.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said, my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Delve into the visceral world of hip-hop with the Gangsta Chronicles, a podcast that aims to unravel the intricate tapestry of one of music's most influential and misunderstood subgenres, gangsta rap. Hosted by MC8 and Big Steels every Thursday, each episode provides an in-depth exploration into the formative artists, monumental albums, and socio-political factors that have shaped gangsta rap from its emergence in the 80s to its enduring impact today. Gangsta Chronicles unpacks the evolution of this uniquely American art form. We dive into the socio-cultural aspects that gangsta rap boldly addressed, from police brutality to systemic racism, offering listeners a comprehensive understanding of the profound cultural significance this genre holds. Listen to the Gangsta Chronicles on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go.
So today, I am super honored to be joined by Joan and Loki Mulholland. I will let them introduce themselves in their own words because the breadth of experience they bring with them is kind of impressive. It's sort of like, yeah, there's a lot going on there. But yeah, whoever would like to start, tell us a little bit about yourselves and what y'all do.
Go on, boy.
I was going to say ladies first, but all right. Well, my name is Loki Mulholland. I'm Joan's son. I'm a filmmaker, activist, author, and yeah.
We see you represent over there, yeah. Joan Mulholland, I'm Loki's mama, and Loki was after the Norse god of mischief, Thor's sidekick, and he's lived up to it. I'm a Delta. I got into a lot of good trouble back in the day. And
You know, freedom rider and all that sort of stuff.
Good job.
Yeah, you knew a lot of folks that people may recognize when, you know, we are studying the history of the civil rights movement. Medgar Evers, Fannie Lou Hamer, people like that.
It's Fannie Lou Hamer.
Hamer. Oh my God, have I been saying that around my whole life? See, this is why we need better civics and Black history education in the schools. Because growing up, I've taught myself most of what I know as an adult, like, you know, reading online, reading books, et cetera, because they don't really teach you what you need to know in school, unfortunately.
Oh, what I learned was that, you know, the slaves were happy and the slave masters were kind.
Yeah, I actually have a friend who's a professor at a university in Hartford who studies how even back to like slavery texts from like ancient Greece, the way that like the happy slave narrative was even a thing then, and like how that then, you know, factors into the way people sometimes use classics like in white supremacist movements to say like, oh, the purity of the Western tradition. But yeah, like, unless you really teach yourself, you can, get stuck with some of these.
Oh, that's interesting, back to the ancient Greeks, because when we had standardized testing, I think it's pretty much out now in Virginia, but one of the questions for the kids is, what did we get from the Greeks? And you were supposed to say, you know, democracy, voting rights, stuff like that. I said, no, that's wrong. We got voting rights for free property owning white men.
Precisely.
We got some highways.
Yeah. Maybe some like column shapes, you know, like some art. But yeah, we're still trying to get voting rights today. You know what I'm saying? So. Well, I'm really, really excited to have y'all here today. Particularly, I'm super interested in the way that movement work manifests in the various different kinds of things you do. And also, we've got two generations of people here who are doing the good work. And I think that like the idea of intergenerational like liberation movement struggle is not one we talk about enough. Like, we got the young kids out here, like the Sunrise Movement or et cetera. And then we study, you know, civil rights history as if it, you know, it happened long ago and like we don't need to be marching anymore, things like that. So how do you see your work from two different generations overlapping or diverging at certain points?
Well, I say my generation got rid of the segregation laws, but the underlying racism is still there. And that's what you know, folks need to work on now. We marched, we sat in, we went to jail, you know, things like that. We could sing real good, except for me, I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. Back in Jackson, Mississippi, the joke, we had a little joke in the movement that if the police were marching on us, they'd just push Joan to the front. And she would sing loudly right in their face, and they would back off because I sang that bad.
Oh, but what is that? Yeah, yeah.
Come for backup. Loki's a good singer, though. But
you're a singer too, on top of everything, Loki.
Yeah, I am. Play guitar and all that stuff. Yeah,
he's all.
I'm a Renaissance man.
Well, maybe we'll come back to the question about like generational differences, because we're kind of starting to talk about art, and that's something that I don't know a lot about from my studying of like civil rights and like other liberation movements, is like what the role of art was during that era. Loki, you know, brilliant filmmaker, and as a hip-hop artist, see the potential for use of that to spread stories that bring people into the movement, educate people, etc. But Joan, like what role did like music and film and art and stuff like that play in your time?
Well, film wasn't a big deal except, you know, watching the evening news on TV. And singing, that was the backbone of the movement. That is what gave us strength and courage to keep on keeping on. And it was, you know, songs that were sort of adapted from the church songs. And it sounded, if you weren't listening to the words, like you were in church. I only had these Yankees coming down, and you know, they were good people, but they sang like they were on a picket line, a union picket line.
Yeah, which side are you on?
They didn't know how to sing. And art, well, you needed art for posters and picket signs and things like that. So that was sort of where it was at.
And so Loki today, working in film and, you know, a variety of media, honestly, what do you see as the role of art in movement making today?
Well, I mean, and I want to kind of echo what my mom says, but roll back a little bit further, because obviously art was used even during the time of slavery.
Yeah, absolutely.
The songs were used to give directions and how to get north. The artistry that went into quilts. Obviously, literature was a key component. And the abolitionist movement.
Yeah.
You know, so those sort of things. And it continued. I mean, obviously, during my mom's time, I mean, film was used as well. A lot of times that was used, the documentary. It's not like it is today where we have so much more access to that. It was more underground. That was that burgeoning movement of art to really kind of push forward these ideals and these alternative narratives to the prescribed history that was taught in our textbooks. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing today as well. And we continue to see, obviously, during the 80s and 90s in particular, with Public Enemy, NWA, and so forth. I mean, all of that, those scenes were just these narratives that people hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. When I say people, I mean white America.
People that control the media, pretty much, yeah.
The photographers with the press,
mm-hmm.
they were powerful. I say, you take it to the lunch counter, the lawyers take it to the court, but the press takes it to the world. And when things would start flying, the press was in every bit as much danger as the demonstrators, and sometimes they were the first ones attacked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the picture of the Jackson Woolworth sit-in, which I'm sure you've seen, where I'm having sugar dumped on my head, as I like to say, like I wasn't sweet enough already. But that went worldwide. It was colorized. Color was added to the black and white. They didn't have color photography in the press then, but in the Paris Match, front page above the centerfold, the most powerful place in the newspaper. And this was the most powerful newspaper in Europe. It was like the New York Times. So that, went. And when I was in South Africa a few years ago, thinking of the music, down in Cape Town, a bunch of us ladies went to a school for a morning of volunteer work. And I ended up, since I used to work in the schools up here, it's up from Georgia, it's still mm-hmm. down south in Arlington,
yeah,
Robert E. Lee's hometown. But we told the students what we did back in the States. We had Q&A, and then we had our closing statement. And I said, back in the days of our civil rights movement, we had a song, We Shall Overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my intention was to say, whatever difficulty you're facing in life, tell yourself those three words and things will get better. No, I got cut right off by the school teacher. This is a room packed with fourth graders. And he said, oh, we sang that song in our apartheid demonstrations. Class, let's all sing it together. So there I was, over 50 years since our civil rights, student civil rights movement, singing We Shall Overcome in Cape Town, South Africa, in a room packed with fourth or fifth graders. And it just about brought me to tears. So
yeah, wow.
It traveled.
Yeah, and so I think about that. I think about, as I was saying previously, about Public Enemy, NWA, I mean, Spike Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, those works and these messages that were put forth that white America hadn't heard and really didn't understand or want to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and I mean, it was almost, it's like a canary in the mine sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow. I mean, all of that has come to pass and then some.
Yeah, and yeah.
Technology today, now what's, when my mom was talking about the press and the cameras and stuff, obviously the quickest way to censor that was just bash a camera and rip out the film.
Which they did.
And today we have, those other techniques now of blocking channels or streams on social media and so forth, mm-hmm. and saying, this content is offensive or whatever else, and being these filters now.
They did that with the evening news in Jackson. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's right.
Medgar Evers. Technical difficulties.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Medgar Evers' speech. I just think about, these new opportunities that exist, like TikTok and so forth. That is a very quick way to get the message across and how people are learning. Yeah, no, I mean, there's still space for longer formats and so forth. And obviously the tools that are there to share those messages. Probably part of the pitfall of that is so much disinformation that gets out there. Mm-hmm. The lack of research, the lack of study, the lack of understanding and context and so forth. So there's, and then obviously the immediate feedback that you get from people who, and the bombing, the trolling and so forth that takes place.
Oh yeah.
Social media to just kind of discredit and take people down rabbit holes away from the core message. I did a post just the other day about Amir Locke.
Mm-hmm.
How it took 9 seconds, and someone said, well, it's actually 6 seconds because he was waiting for three of them. I'm like,
okay.
Really? Okay, right, exactly.
Yeah, like, yeah. The way people parse details to delegitimize, like,
right,
very real things.
Yeah. Oh, we used humor also in the movement. If your mama ever told you not to drink coffee because it would turn you black, you know, back in the days before black was beautiful,
mm-hmm.
I am living proof that it ain't so. Mama probably just wanted all that coffee for herself.
For herself, yeah. She could have probably used some of that sugar they dumped on you, though, so, you know, sweeten it up a little bit.
Yeah, that could be.
But I think you started to get into my next question, Loki. It's about, I mean, we've spoken really to two parts of it. I'm really interested in the way you sort of describe the long history of the arts in various movements, highlighting the way that even the abolitionist movement for the abolition of slavery, you know, literature and songs were so critical. And so I'm curious, you know, sticking to this theme of intergenerational struggle, what parts do you see yourself carrying forward from previous movements, having been very, I guess, enmeshed in its history growing up with Joan? And what sorts of new things? I mean, you mentioned TikTok already, but what are some of the differences that you try to lean into in your modern day work?
Well, not so much differences. For me, it's, you know, I've been asked repeatedly, would I have sat at the lunch counter? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I would have.
Yeah.
But I don't have to because my mother already did. This kind
of
excuse.
Yeah. Those different, there's like things like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really, it's, we all have a role to play. Not everyone could sit at the lunch counters. Not everyone had a disposition. There was threats on families. You know, they could lose their tuition, all these different jobs or houses be bombed and whatever else. And some people, you know, they just weren't at that place at that time, you know, and so they found other ways to contribute. So I use the gifts that I've been given to, you know, move that work forward, move that message forward, and to highlight the history. At the end of the day, whether we're going to go back to abolitionists or civil rights movement or any sort of movement, it really comes down to that one-on-one opportunity of seeing those individuals, seeing those people sitting at the lunch counter, that you have to actually confront it. It's right there in front of you, that you just can't replicate in a film or you know, in a photograph or anything, or literature.
Or a rap song, yeah.
Yeah, or a rap song. It just becomes, the art becomes a way to motivate people, you know, to inspire, to inform. But really, it's to do all that to get you down to those lunch counters, on the buses, or in the streets, carrying the signs and putting forth that message to move things forward.
And signing a petition online is not, you know, really bringing about a big change. It's just making you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I posted a TikTok earlier about getting off Twitter and like getting in the streets, whether that's knocking on your neighbor's doors or marching or going to City Hall, whatever you gotta do. But yeah, I like the idea of everyone having their role to play. That kind of makes me rethink my question in that a lot of the things we need to do are the same, and that like certain people put their bodies on the line, certain people are documenting it. It's really about folks finding the intersection of their passion and what the gifts they're given with the tools that are available at the time. So now we do have TikTok and Instagram to like make sure those images of protests are circulated.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of project, just new tool.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, we're in a capitalist society. Money makes the world turn. I mean, you had people beyond the Harry Belafonte's of the world. You had actually white women whose husbands were probably either in the Klan or in the White Citizens Council in Jackson, who were giving money to the maids, to the help, right? Mm-hmm. To give back to Medgar Evers' office. They knew they couldn't give it directly, so they would sneak it in. And this is known. There was a gentleman's great story. He, his gift was robbing jewelry stores.
Hey, whatever, that's what you got.
He would time out the train and how long it would take the police to get to the jewelry store, rob the store, hop the train, go to the next town, sell the goods, do it, rinse and repeat. And that money went back to the NAACP. Now, they had no idea where it was coming from.
I didn't know that.
I'm sure if they did, they might be like,
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, hey, you use the gifts you've been given.
Sure do.
Not endorsing breaking into stores and selling the goods for money, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I could use being white to the advantage of the movement. Mm-hmm. I could blend into the crowd and be an observer of what was happening. I could, at Glen Echo Amusement Park, just over in Maryland, I could go in and buy tickets. I knew where to buy me to have a ticket for each ride you got on, ticket in hand. And I could go back out and hand them out to the Howard students who hopped on the merry-go-round, ticket in hand, and got arrested.
What were the passes that you gave to Medgar?
When I was a Tougaloo student, I went up to the state legislature and got a handful of passes to, you know, sit in the galleries and watch the legislature debate things. Went back, gave those to Medgar, and he handed them out to the most prominent black ministers he could find. And they got arrested, gallery pass in hand. And by the next day, the law had changed that you had to personally get your pass from your representative. But there were a number of times just being white could be used to the advantage of the movement. So you got to use what you got.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people are still waking up to that today. I'm thinking about how, I mean, broadly, people say use your privilege, et cetera, but
right.
The specific ways where it's like, use your whiteness to like get in those spaces where others can't, and things like that. Joan, I had one question for you. So we talked a little bit about what Loki takes from movements before, but I was wondering if there's anything that young movement makers are doing today that you find interesting or inspiring.
Well, I find that complete diversity. Mm-hmm. Of the crowds and the marches, to say nothing of the size of the crowds and the marches. But I think you've got a much, you know, like a no majority massive demonstration. We didn't have that. We had just a handful of white or Hispanic or Asian folks in our activities and marches. Well, we didn't have so many marches because you'd all get arrested. Before you got down the block.
Before you got there, yeah.
And the police are even joining the marchers and protesters, holding hands with them, kneeling to pray with them. Mm-hmm. It just blows my mind.
That makes me think as well about, talking about like then and now. So at the time, from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joan, it seemed like a lot of folks that took part in the civil rights movement were somewhat demonized. I saw recently a comic from, I think, the Birmingham News, where they were painting MLK as starting riots, even though nonviolence was the core of the movement. And then yet, today, the same people that are disrupting modern movements, sending the National Guard in when folks are marching and tear gassing folks, are heralding civil rights movement leaders at the same time. And so I was wondering what you both make of trends like that, where you see a sort of contradiction in the way folks treat both historic and modern civil rights movements.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, immediately comes to mind is someone like Ted Cruz, who in one breath will praise, you know, quote Dr. King at his convenience, and then say that appointing a, you know, even the idea of appointing a black woman is an affront to, an insult to black women, mm-hmm. and you know, and equality, mm-hmm. which is just absurd to begin with. Like, he cares. But yeah, you know, Dr. King, when he was killed, 70% of white America, well, you know, didn't like him if you looked at the polls and stuff. But now, right. You know, it's weaponizing Dr. King to push forward, you know, these agendas of like, you know, anti-CRT, which right. CRT, of course, is not taught in school.
Which is not even a thing, yeah.
But it's a whole thing to roll back, you know, the narrative that they feel uncomfortable with. And quite frankly, don't even understand.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating thing to even contemplate, mm-hmm. but that's where it's so vital for the rest of us to be informed. And
yes.
And when I have people who quote Dr. King like that, I'm like, hey, yes, that's wonderful. What about the rest of his speech?
Yeah, do you remember any words after the first seven?
Well, do you know the words that he said before that?
Or yeah.
Because everything before that was about reparations. I mean, let's talk about that for a moment.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, a federal job guarantee. Let's talk about the evils of capitalism and militarism. Nobody wants to get into that. But Joan, from your perspective, having lived through that and seeing the way that people treat it today, what is that like for you?
aside from comical. They want to idealize it, what we did. Mm-hmm. And we were not perfect. We made mistakes. There are things we could have done better and all that. But they want to use us as, you know, that we did it all and they don't need to do anything. And they need to look deeper. I mean, like I say, we took care of the laws for segregation, but there is so much more. The racism behind, and then the forms that the racism takes, housing, whose neighborhood does the interstate tear up, where does the school money go? Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, some schools get hand-me-downs anymore like it used to be, but certainly they say, you know, I'm in Arlington, and they say South Arlington gets the least and North Arlington gets the most because the rich folks live there and the power base, but it doesn't need to be that way. Discrimination against people because of their first language, their ethnic origins, their religion, all that stuff. I was impressed a few years ago when the anti-Muslim thing got going, that college kids, girls in some places, were walking around with their classmates wearing hijabs, just like their classmates were. But there are lots of ways to show solidarity. Mm-hmm. There's lots more forms of discrimination that we now recognize.
And part of that comes to mind as well is how we, you know, so part of it is like Dr. King was a commie, right? All that sort of stuff.
All that stuff, yeah.
Just like the Washington football team will now be. Hail to the commies.
I didn't think about that. I love that, though. It's funny.
But, you know, those same terms are thrown around. They don't even know what they mean. But I think what's really fascinating is there's part of this element of the civil rights movement's kind of safe to talk about. Mm-hmm. As long as you don't talk about why it happened, of course. But there's this, you know, the sort of glorification, if you will, of, you know, there's the Freedom Riders and the sit-ins and all this, you know, John Lewis on the Edmund Pettus Bridge and Dr. King, I Had a Dream, all that sort of stuff. Because it means, hey, problem solved. And I actually did a TikTok video on this recently, just talking about, you know, what scares white America about teaching history is that it's their own history. Because at my age, when I was in elementary school, Dr. King had only been killed, you know, 16 years earlier or so. Mm-hmm. World War II had only ended about 40 years earlier. Mm-hmm. So if you take today and roll back that same time period, 40 years ago, the Philadelphia Police Department was bombing their own city.
Right, and so few people know about that still.
Yeah. Lucky, you're off in your math. World War II ended 45, and you were in elementary school in the late 70s.
Right, I was in elementary school in the 80s, Mom. I was 10 years old in 1980.
Okay, well, that's still not 40 years.
Oh, okay, Mother. So nonetheless, World War II was raging 40 years earlier. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, that's safe.
Mom, math is your worst subject, and you're trying to school me on it, Mother. but if you go back 31 years ago, Rodney King was beaten. 24 right. years ago, you know, James Byrd was lynched. Mm-hmm. You know, in Jasper, Texas, right? Dragged behind a pickup truck, chained by his feet until his body fell apart. 10 years ago is Trayvon.
Yeah.
These were the things, that's the same type of stuff they would have been teaching us back then if they were even going to teach that.
Mm-hmm. They weren't going to teach it.
But so if you take a look at that time frame, that's what really scares them because they were alive during that. They understand that. And it's like, wow, that happened on our watch. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what we didn't do.
Yeah. And the history of racism is so, it's taught as Black history. When it's really white history, and that there's a lot of white people that were doing it as well. History. Folks like Joan that were out there marching with people. It was like a shared struggle for some folks.
But I mean, CRT is just straight out and out U.S. history.
It's just U.S. history, yeah.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed. cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Delve into the visceral world of hip-hop with the Gangsta Chronicles, a podcast that aims to unravel the intricate tapestry of one of music's most influential and misunderstood subgenres, gangsta rap. Hosted by MC8 and Big Steels every Thursday, each episode provides an in-depth exploration into the formative artists, monumental albums, and socio-political factors that have shaped gangsta rap from its emergence in the 80s to its enduring impact today. Gangsta Chronicles unpacks the evolution of this uniquely American art form. We dive into the socio-cultural aspects that gangsta rap boldly addressed, from police brutality to systemic racism, offering listeners a comprehensive understanding of the profound cultural significance this genre holds. Listen to the Gangsta Chronicles on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go.
I was very interested in something you said, John, about how you all made mistakes. There's things that you would have done differently. And that's certainly not a piece of history that they teach people in the way that they idealize the struggle at the time.
Well, LaVon Brown mom talks about that. It might jog your memory a little bit. But when there was that schism in SNCC, the SNCC leadership between John.
Well, that was after my...
You know, I think the thing that I kind of focus on at times about the civil rights movement is we kind of forget, you know, we focus on these key singular moments, the Greensboro sit-in and the Freedom Rise and this, that, and this. But, you know, and assume that one thing took care of everything. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we can condense these things down to just a couple of days here and there and poof, everything's solved. I mean, Greensboro did not fix Jackson. Greensboro fixed Greensboro.
Right.
Jackson fixed Jackson. Right.
Right.
We all need to work within the space and where we live. You know, as my mom would say, you know, that's the hippies say, you know, bloom where you're planted.
Right. Right.
We tell kids, don't try to change the world. Change your world, whatever that might be. And for my mom, it was the South. Right. She wanted to make the South the best.
I didn't care about them Yankees.
Let them fix their own stuff. They got their own different problems that they'll tackle.
Well, you know, Malcolm X was working on that. Right.
So, right. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I really appreciate you raising that because I think I speak to like middle schools, high schools all the time. And I've been thinking a lot about how this like civil rights history is kind of painted for a lot of kids, like something that happened somewhere else as part of the way where they're trying to discourage people from like carrying those struggles forward. It's like, oh, they were marching. Yeah, they were marching on Washington. They were marching down in Mississippi. I was like, no, they were marching in Athens, Georgia. Like we had our own movement here.
You had
that they don't want you to know about because you
we
might
had
keep
a riot
it going.
There.
In Athens?
Oh, yeah.
At the university.
Wait, you went when it integrated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, I do recall that. They don't teach you about that.
That inspired me to go to Tougaloo, watching that so close to where my family was from, Nicholson, that if integration was real, I was thinking it's got to be a two-way street. Maybe I should apply to a colored school, that being the polite term then. Mm-hmm. And I talked it over with my friends, you know, the leadership of SNCC, and they thought it was a good idea. And somebody said, well, if you're going to do it, you may as well go to Mississippi. Those students haven't done anything yet, meaning demonstrations. Maybe you can help them. And so I applied to Tougaloo, since it was the only nationally accredited school that colored students could go to. Sorry about that phone. I don't know how to mute it.
It's all good. I got a baby yodel in the background. We got phones. It's an orchestra.
And I was accepted at Tougaloo, even though my high school up here refused very pointedly, without spelling it out, to send my transcripts. But they still accepted me. They said, oh, well, we'll take you on your Duke University transcripts. I'd gone there for 1 year and we parted company when I wanted to go back to school. That was right after the riots. You know?
That is such an interesting idea that I don't think people embrace enough, that like integration does have to be a two-way street. It's not just about like advancing, you know, getting people of color in positions of power and into these white spaces. It's also like, I got this one friend, this like white dude who like shows up at like all of these like all black events that are just happen to be in black communities, but he's out there doing the work of meeting people, of helping people, of talking to folks. But so many people are scared to do that because there is that lingering racism. Like, even if you try to be an anti-racist, it's like, oh, if I show up, like, people will laugh at me, or I won't, you know, I don't want to understand, et cetera. But that's a really important thing for us to remember as well. So,
and there are lots of different ways to make a difference. I mean, I was sitting in and all that, then I had a family, and that really, I had to take care of the kids. But at their elementary school, I made a difference. I particularly want to, in a number of different ways, but the music teacher, who lived a couple blocks from me, wanted a good song to teach for, I think it was, you know, Black History Month. And I said, well, lift every voice and sing. She had not a clue, but she looked it up. She wanted to teach it to something to teach to the chorus to sing it at our big international dinner. Mm-hmm. She ended up teaching that song to every kid in the school, and they sang it at the international dinner with the chorus standing on the stage, but every kid, you know, singing. Probably the first, I'm, you know, 99.9% sure it's the first formerly all-white school in the county, if not the state, for all the kids to learn Lift Every Voice and Sing. But there were a number of other things too, but the biggest deal in my book.
It's not just like study, again, like the big event, studying, you know, what happened in Greensboro. It's also just knowing about cultural artifacts from our communities, like taking the time to learn a very important song to us and things like that. Yeah. Yeah.
I took care of, they had all these white doll babies and soldiers. Sounds kindergarten class, and it was the girls' corner and the boys' corner. Well, I took care of the doll babies by making a bunch of cloth dolls out of different skin tone scraps I had and interchangeable clothes, and those white plastic doll babies disappeared. And then I said, well, now my son, he's going to be upset by you calling that the girls' corner, because he wanted an ironing board, a small ironing board for Christmas.
Yeah.
And he's not going to be happy about you saying that's a girl thing. Well, it quickly changed to the housekeeping corner and the workshop corner. When the school I was working in, I would go in with the second grade classes every year and read books about segregation, Dr. King, and the American South. I mean, that's where they were placed, picture books to the second graders, and alternate those with South Africa, apartheid, and Nelson Mandela. And I have had, now decades later, adults walk up to me and remind me, they remembered when I taught them all that in class. So I think I made a difference in my small ways.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I really appreciate y'all sharing so much history I didn't know about and reframing the history that I knew. But I'd also love to ask y'all about what you're working on these days. So let's start with you, Loki. What are you getting into these days?
Oh, gosh. What am I working on right now?
What aren't you doing these days?
Well, you know, I've discovered TikTok after a while. Been working on that, sharing a lot of content there, you know, and
outing, you know, your mama.
Yeah, more of my mom's stories, kind of stuff you don't hear about in the
yeah, that's so cool. I love it. Yeah.
And then trying to interject a few little things that I have as well. You know, we finished shooting a film, a little short documentary about a gentleman who every day he goes, he's 92 years old, and every day he goes to the Edmund Pettus Bridge to pray for the state trooper that beat him on Bloody Sunday.
Wow.
I'm working on a whole diversity, equity, inclusion training modules, you know, that will be a whole online platform for
awesome.
That incorporates my mom's story and the various films, you know, that I've done and using those as kind of a training tools as well. You know, working on an Emmett Till film, that's mm-hmm. been a long process that continues, you know, that just got kind of kiboshed with the COVID and so forth.
Yeah.
We're starting to, you know, okay, let's go back and reevaluate that a little more. And mm-hmm. then working on another season of our Uncomfortable Truth podcast. So we're getting ramped up for that. So yeah, just, you know, the usual.
The usual, you know, the usual. Well, that's all really exciting. And what about you, John? What irons you got in the fire these days?
Well, I can't march anymore because my knees have given out, but I can run my mouth pretty
yes,
good.
Yes, yes.
So I do
that.
A lot of public speaking. The Deltas had me out to Memphis, the alumni chapter, and I was talking out there, and I just was talking at a Hampton-Sydney University and with Loki along with me on this and showing video clips in Farmville, Virginia, which was crucial to getting the schools integrated in Virginia. It even went into Brown versus Board,
mm-hmm.
Moton High School. And I speak in local elementary schools, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, colleges, and anybody that invites me. And if I got a transportation issues, they got to pay for my transportation, put me up and feed me somewhere, private home, five-star hotel, either way. Yeah, running my mouth is my main thing now.
I love that. I'm going to remember that for the rest of my life.
As long as the brain cells still work and the sun yeah. will cut me off when they don't.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, any closing words of hope for our listeners? Y'all have been at it for a minute, creating beautiful art and sharing beautiful stories to, you know, keep this movement alive. But what's one last thing you'd like people to know as we part ways to give them
get
some
out there
the
and
fight?
Do something.
Get out there. Yeah, I feel that.
Things do get better. People didn't believe slavery would end, but
that's
it
right.
did. They didn't believe Jim Crow was going to end,
mm-hmm.
but it did. But it ended because, you know, like to echo the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, they were sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Period.
And so we got to keep pressing forward because the other side's not tired.
But yeah, how do people keep in touch with your work, find your work, you know, continue to learn from you all?
Obviously, you know, like I said before, we're on TikTok. So Loki Mulholland is it a page? Is it a channel? What do they call it?
I'm really new to TikTok also. So yeah, I think a page. I don't know. But it's fire content. Please go check it out. Yes.
Yeah, you know, we're on Instagram and Facebook and stuff.
You have a foundation with mama's name on it.
Yep. I was getting there, mom. So if you go to our website, www.thejtmfoundation.org. Don't know why I put the www in the beginning of that. That shows how old I am now. So thejtmfoundation.org. And that's where we have scholarship programs there that we're doing. We've got obviously our films. People can contribute.
Please go check out thejtmfoundation.org to learn more. Follow Loki on TikTok and Instagram at Loki Mulholland, and keep up the fight. You know, they've been out here doing it for a minute, creating beautiful art, sharing beautiful stories, but we're going to make our own new stories. carrying forward the fight. But yeah, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Delve into the visceral world of hip-hop with the Gangsta Chronicles, a podcast that aims to unravel the intricate tapestry of one of music's most influential and misunderstood subgenres, gangsta rap. Hosted by MC8 and Big Steels every Thursday, each episode provides an in-depth exploration into the formative artists, monumental albums, and socio-political factors that have shaped gangsta rap from its emergence in the 80s to its enduring impact today. Gangsta Chronicles unpacks the evolution of this uniquely American art form. We dive into the socio-cultural aspects that gangsta rap boldly addressed, from police brutality to systemic racism, offering listeners a comprehensive understanding of the profound cultural significance this genre holds. Listen to the Gangsta Chronicles on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Let's go.
Hey, yo.
Hey.
We are back. That was Joan Mulholland and her son Loki. That was quite a robust conversation y'all had there.
Yeah, I tried not to get into like specifics, like what was it like to meet Medgar Evers, but still kind of like understand more of just like what lessons can be drawn from the work that they have done. And so I hope that's been helpful to everybody listening and thinking about your own role in movements, the work that is still left to be done, etc. I definitely feel like I got a lot of that.
No, you definitely did. Definitely did. And y'all make sure that y'all check out that documentary so you can get a more robust picture of her full biography and the things that she did. Well, I do. Oh, you know what? We got to throw out a congratulations, Mariah. Our homie, the person who you've never heard, who spins us the beats, Joel.
Joel!
Brought a new bundle of joy
Yay.
Into the world.
Dad stat is now dad stat times two. Congratulations, so, Joel.
Congrats.
He's not going to hear this because he's probably like knee deep in dirty diapers right now. But
who's taking over? I think it's Taylor taking over.
Yeah,
his
shout
spot
out to Tay-Tay for
hey, Taylor, you know, we know you're new to this, Taylor, but we got a rap to close us out. So can you pick through one of those instrumentals of mine and play us something? Yeah. Wait, now reparations. situation.
Picket in and sitting in, they bodies on the line, getting jailed and getting fined, demanding human rights. At the time they demonized, but now they getting shined. No surprise, they sanitized the fight, the fascists on the rise, acting like they would've stood up, but really they would've stood up a wooden cross and burning like some Buddha, terrorizing the neighborhood with their hoods up. They really shook, bruh, watching all the people as they mobilized, looking back at MLK like, I know that guy. They don't even know the half. Motherfuckers, I know you whack.
When the revolution's over, exploding like a nova, I just took a ride to Kroger, nobody pulled me over. I got blunts on sight, and ain't nobody sober. Yo, my name's Dope Knife, my mama call me Toga. Go and smoke up, it's all legal. We all regal, all ball, no such thing as small people. Gun sticks, pots and pans, we fought evil. Now we got plots of land, 4-0. Told you not to dream, said it's all in your head. They told you not to lead, said to follow instead. Now you can get a good job, keeping all of your dreads, and we can party without caring, go and call the feds. Everybody dapping, no one having a fuss. Came a long damn way from the back of the bus, and we let in the white folks that we happen to trust, and everybody else can come but as black as a fuck. Yeah, we waiting on reparations. Ooh,
ooh.
My name's Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca,
and we are waiting on reparations.
Peace.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating.
I got a big heart, and I'm very forgiving, but, like, don't abuse it. It's been abused enough.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hills and Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school, like,
yeah.
Okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.